And if that pretty little girl from across the street, who's been bothering me for days, to go swimming in her pool, well, her pool's real cool, but it hasn't got 10-foot waves, tell her I'm surfing.
She's a mighty, mighty cute girl.
Tell her I'm surfing. If she wants my company, I'll be out at wind and sea, I'm going surfing. Last year I had a summer job, and all day long I had to run around. But now I can't afford a new surfboard, and all summer long I'm gonna bum around. So just pack me a lunch and I'll be on my way. Oh yeah, there's one more thing to do. If the mailman comes with a letter from me, just forward it to Malibu, where I'll be surfing.
Just drop it in my 34-4.
Tell him I'm surfing.
I'll be the one waxing my board now.
I won't be home for days. I'll be riding the waves. I'm going surfing. 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 I'm going surfing.
Oh, yeah, there you have the Fantastic Baggies. Tell them I'm surfing. And that'll do it for the Wrecking Hours annual surf set today. And just leaving you with something from the Mermen, their tune called Honeycomb. And next up, we have the Monday Talk Forum with Philosophy Talk and TED Talks. Be sure to tune in for that right after these messages. You're listening to WHFR Dearborn, the station making waves, 89.3 FM in Detroit, WHFR.FM on the internet. This is WHFR Dearborn. Stay tuned now for the Monday Talk Forum.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
Thank you for listening to Philosophy Talk's free weekly download.
You can do your part for intelligent, reflective media by making a tax-deductible contribution to Philosophy Talk.
We really do rely on your support. Any contribution, big or small, will help us stay on the air and online.
And donating is very simple. Just visit our website at philosophytalk.org and click the donate link.
Thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk, and thank you for thinking.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from Cubberly Auditorium at the School of Education on the Stanford campus.
Our thinking originates not very far from here at Philosopher's Corner, where Ken and I teach philosophy.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today, corporations and the future of democracy.
Well, can that title suggest that corporations are perhaps a potential threat to democracy? So maybe we should get clear at the outset about exactly what a corporation is.
Well, John, you know, there are lots of ways that corporations might and I think do threaten democracy, but all of these threats are rooted in one basic concept, a concept that's actually key to the nature of a corporation. That's the idea of limited liability.
Limited liability is the idea that the individuals behind a corporation, the ones that start it, the ones that put up their money for its activities, can shield themselves from full financial responsibility for the risks that the corporation takes. The thinking is that if people can protect themselves from full liability, they'll be willing to take greater risks and try new things. Limited liability encourages the kind of creativity and innovation that our country and Silicon Valley are built upon.
Yeah, and limited liability in that sense is a great thing, but you know, it's a double-edged sword. There are no unmixed blessings in life. Because limited liability also enables corporations to do things like, well, pollute and destroy the natural environment without having to take full responsibility. For example, suppose a corporation has causes $1 million worth of environmental damage. Actually, that's kind of peanuts. But it's a really small corporation and only has $1,000 in assets. Basically, the corporation can go bankrupt, walk away from the damage it caused, and leave the rest of us stuck with the bill.
Even if it doesn't do that, the mere threat of going bankrupt can be used in negotiation and in litigation. If a lawsuit against a corporation is too successful, ironically, the corporation can just declare bankruptcy, and the plaintiffs won't get near as much as they should.
So far, it sounds, we've talked about a small corporation, but even a huge corporation with major assets can leverage the threat of bankruptcy to avoid liability for damages that it caused. Remember the BP oil spill in the Gulf. I mean, the mere possibility of BP going bankrupt meant that they were able to get away with causing all that damage, massive damage, without being held fully responsible for that damage.
Today, however, we're interested in the advantages and disadvantages that are peculiar to corporations, what they offer to democracies. So maybe we ought to now say a little bit by what we mean by a democracy.
Well, that's kind of easy. You know, every eligible voter has one vote. And all matters of public policy ultimately are decided by majority rule. I mean, many democracies set aside certain things that are beyond majority rule. That's the point of the Bill of Rights. But basically, one man, one vote. Not one corporation, one vote. One person, one vote.
And many democracies have very undemocratic institutions right in the heart of things, right in the middle of things, like the United States Senate, which gives the vote of a person from Delaware or Alaska or even Wisconsin about 100 times more weight than the vote from someone like you or I in California, Ken.
John, you always go on about this every time we talk about democracy. But look, as imperfect as the U.S. may be in terms of being its democratic institutions, it's got the basic thing about democracy right. People who seek power at any level of government, they have to get votes, lots of votes, votes from the people. So we, the people, have a lot to say about how we're governed, and that's the basic idea of democracy. We, the people, govern, not we, the corporations, govern.
And you don't have to have corporations, though, to have a threat of undermining this basic idea. Someone can use their money to buy or otherwise unduly influence the votes of the electorate. So instead of getting the wisdom of the majority, we're just getting the reflection of money. And in a representative democracy, things can even be done more efficiently. You can go directly to the elected officials and bribe them instead of buying votes.
That's true. But, you know, corporations raise the ante tremendously. Because, you know, however rich an individual may be, corporations are bound to be even richer. I mean, think of the huge multinational corporations of today. There's really no limit to the resources that they can bring to bear on the political process, for example, if we allow them to do that.
Ken, isn't this really just the problem that the Supreme Court Citizens United decision, if it didn't create, at least it exacerbated terribly? They held that corporations are persons, which they seem to have taken very literally. So they're persons that have the right of free speech. And that speech can take the form of money. So corporations can now spend all the money they want on political campaigns.
You know, Johnny, you're right. It raises lots of questions. I mean, what does it even mean to say that money is speech? Or that a corporation, I mean, think of what is a corporation. It's an entity with no thoughts, feelings, emotions, or intentions. What does it mean to say that's a person? I mean, should a non-breathing creation of the law, that's what a corporation is, a creation of the law, have most of the rights but few of the responsibilities of a living, breathing human citizen?
We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, to learn more about a case where the question of corporate personhood and corporate responsibility was central and crucial. She files this report.
Our story begins in the early 1990s in Nigeria's Delta region, home to the native Ogoni people. Around the Delta, multinational companies had been extracting crude oil for decades. Back in the 90s, Royal Dutch Petroleum had a contract with the brutal military dictatorship.
And like most huge companies that go into places like Nigeria to do extracting work, they set about basically wrecking the environment and the culture of the local people.
Peter Weiss is a retired lawyer and vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. He's an expert on the case against Royal Dutch Petroleum that's making its way through the Supreme Court. To understand the case, it's important to know what happened to a man named Ken Sarawiwa. Here's a clip from his last interview in 1995.
To take away the resources of a people and refuse to give them anything in return is to subject them to slavery.
In the 90s, Sarawiwa was a leading Nigerian intellectual. He was a poet, an environmental activist, a TV producer, the son of an Ogoni chieftain. Sarawiwa and others started organizing people in the region against the oil companies.
I accuse the oil companies of encouraging genocide against the Ogoni people. I accuse Shell and Chevron of practicing racism against the Ogoni people because they do in Ogoni what they do not do in other parts of the world where they prospect for oil.
Then one day, four local leaders were killed. Sarawiwa and other activists were framed for the murders. They were quickly convicted by a special military tribunal, and they were hanged. Attorney Peter Weiss believes Royal Dutch Petroleum helped the government get false convictions by promising people jobs at Shell. Here's a clip from a BBC interview with activist Ben Amunwa.
Shell refused to listen to peaceful, nonviolent organizers like Ken Sarawiwa and conspired to silence him and others in a range of brutal crackdowns against the Ogoni.
Today, the company is accused of helping the Nigerian government torture and execute Ogoni activists. The case before the U.S. Supreme Court is called Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Petroleum. It's being brought on behalf of the relatives of victims like Esther Kiobel, whose husband was hanged alongside Ken Sarawiwa. But why is a part Dutch, part British company on trial in an American courtroom for atrocities committed more than 15 years ago in Nigeria? Because of something called the Alien Tort Statute. Again, attorney Peter Weiss.
Well, that's a law that I like to think of as the Sleeping Beauty Law because it sat there for two centuries without being used. And it says that an alien can sue in federal court for a tort in violation of what was then called the Law of Nations, which we now call international law.
The law has been used, largely unsuccessfully, to bring suits against corporations like a Canadian oil company, Coca-Cola, and even Yahoo. Then, about a year and a half ago, in the case of Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Petroleum, a court of appeals ruled the Alien Tort Statute could not be used against corporations, so the plaintiffs appealed to the Supreme Court.
So it's the first case which is raising the question of whether, when the Alien Tort Statute says an alien shall have a right of action, that the word alien includes not only individuals, but also corporations.
In other words, along with the perks, should corporations have the same responsibilities as a person? A decision is expected in the case in the summer of 2013. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks, Caitlin, for bringing us up to date about Royal Dutch Shell and things in Nigeria. There's a connection between that case and events this evening. Kent Sarawiwa was eventually executed, and that was in spite of the determined efforts of our guest, Russ Feingold. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor, and we're coming to you from Cubberley Auditorium on the Stanford campus.
And we're joined now by Senator Russ Feingold. He's a former three-term U.S. senator from the great state of Wisconsin. Here at Stanford, he's the Mimi and Peter Haas Distinguished Visitor at our Haas Center for Public Service. He's author of While America Sleeps, a wake-up call for the post-9/11 era. Senator Feingold, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Senator Feingold, it's a terrific book. It's reads almost like a novel, except a lot of us lived through it, so we know, unfortunately,
sadly,
it's
true.
Not. It mainly concerns the political machinations after 9/11 and their bad effects. More recently, you've been focusing on Citizens United. How come?
Well, I've really focused on the two issues. When I left the Senate, I thought, what do I really want to think about? One is the mistakes we made after 9/11 and sort of to call the country to think more seriously about being aware of the rest of the world. But an issue that I'd worked on for throughout my political career was the issue of campaign finance reform. And in 2010, the Supreme Court made a decision that was absolutely incredible, which was the Citizens United decision that for the first time in any of our lifetimes, if you buy toothpaste or detergent, that money, and a gallon of gas, I might add, that money can now be used immediately for a political candidate that you would never support. It's the first time that's ever happened. That's what that Supreme Court decision did.
Well, we all know about McCain-Feingold. Matter of fact, in here you say a lot of your constituents in Wisconsin came to think your first name was McCain.
Yeah. So and that was McCain, one of McCain's many favorite jokes.
Yes,
yeah.
Right. Now, the basis of Citizens United was the idea that corporations are persons in some limited, strange sense, but whatever that sense was, they had the right of free speech, even though they're really legal fictions. And then you combine that with the idea that speech is money, and you get this mess we're in. I mean, what did the Supreme Court have in mind?
Well, it was really a word game to overturn the progress that we were making in this country on campaign finance reform. The McCain-Feingold bill prevented corporations and unions from doing this, basically running it through the political parties, and we banned the soft money on that. But Citizens United also undid the enthusiasm that people have for the Internet. People turn to the Internet, small contributions. And so what Citizens United said was, well, let's say corporations are persons, you know, they're persons as for purposes of suing or being sued, but they made up a fiction that the founders of this country intended that basically corporations are part of we the people, is not the case.
But you say they made up a fiction. There's no theory behind it? There's no deep thought behind it? You would like to think that the Supreme Court is one of the greatest thinking bodies in the world, and there's a thought behind it. There's no thought behind that.
Oh, there's a motive behind it, and the thought is we got to do something to stop the kind of activism that occurred during the 2008 election. We need corporations to be able to open their treasuries in a way they've never been able to do. Now, the truth is, they could do this prior to 1907, and that was the Gilded Age.
Mm-hmm.
And the country said, wait a minute, we can't have the robber barons running the country. So a law was passed in 1907 to prohibit it, and this is the first time since then that this kind of money came.
I'm going to challenge you on this because, I'd like to believe, I'm a philosopher, and I like to believe in our democracy. There are deep underlying philosophical principles at work. You could probably convince me that I'm wrong about that, but let's see after a break. This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from Stanford University. We're talking about corporations and the future of democracy with former U.S. Senator Russ Feingold.
Corporations are not natural beings. They're things created by the legal system. What sorts of rights and obligations should our laws give to corporations? If corporations are persons, can't we make them responsible persons instead of psychopaths?
Corporations as persons, what kind of persons? Along with questions from our live and lively audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Soccer mom with an old SUV, what can you do for me? You broke down daddy with a farmer's tan, what can you do for me? I'll make you a bet that you'll make all your payments. If you bet me back, you'll default. It's a win-win, my friends. There is no true claimant. It's closing time, the last waltz.
It's a slap in the face to the free marketplace. 'Cause money isn't money till it's moving around.
We'll just stop it.
Money's only money.
We're only impeding
if it's
progress.
Around. Money's only money if we're not around.
Thanks to our musical guests, Merle Kessler and Joshua Raoul Brody, the Playtones. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're talking about corporations and the future of democracy with former U.S. Senator Russell Feingold.
What do you think we should do with corporations? Eliminate them because they're a scourge on mankind? Humankind, I mean? Allow them unbridled freedom as the crucibles of all that is good about the modern world? Or something in between? Join the discussion by stepping up to one of the microphones at either side of the stage.
So, Senator Feingold, I want to think of where corporations came from and how we got to where we are. I mean, when the kings of England began chartering corporations. They were for some very limited, strictly regulated purposes. Now we got whole hordes of people saying, let corporations be, let them do. How did we get from there to here?
Well, that's right. And if you actually read the majority opinion in Citizens United, they trace a little bit of this history. And in fact, even at the founding of the country, as I understand it, corporations were only basically by charter. There wasn't a general law saying you can form a corporation as long as you do X, Y, and Z, you're a corporation under the law. That came later as the country came into formation. So there's nothing inherent in the Constitution or anything that even allows corporations to exist. They could be banned without any violation of the United States Constitution. So it's something that I think is necessary. I think it's good for the economy to have the corporate form, but the idea that somehow it has a constitutional status is simply untrue.
So let's make sure we understand exactly what the Citizens United thing did. Now, I've done a lot of research by watching the Stephen Colbert Show.
Oh, that's the best.
But I find I'm still a little bit confused. So with individuals, even under McCain-Feingold, you could contribute to candidates unlimited, all the money you wanted?
Well, prior to the Watergate era, when the first major campaign finance law was passed, there was kind of an OK Corral environment. I guess $100 briefcases were brought into the Senate cloakroom. But after that, people said, wait a minute, this is corrupting. And so they actually limited contributions by individuals. But way back in 1907, the judgment was made that corporations, and then in 1947, that unions should not use their treasuries for this purpose. So there is a distinction in the law, a long distinction until just recently, between individuals, corporations, and unions.
Now, under McCain-Feingold and before the Citizens United, still as an individual, if I happen to be a multimillionaire, which I'm not, the amount I could give to my favorite politician's campaign was limited, but I could go out and and buy commercials on my own.
Yeah, which people generally didn't do, but one of the things that people were upset about, the famous Buckley v. Vallejo case, is they said you can limit how much you can give to somebody else, but a person could spend all they wanted on their own campaign or if they just wanted to run independent ads. But interestingly, people have not wanted to do that. And right now what you're seeing is not individuals spending their money directly, but hiding behind a corporate shell
Let's slow down a bit, though. Okay, so I, as an individual, can advocate all I want. I could stand on the street corner as long as I wasn't violating, disturbing the peace and say, blah, 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 blah. You know, stop this, do that. Okay, if I had some money, I could buy some TV commercials saying, do this, don't do that, do this. I could do that all I want. John and I could bond together. We could form a partnership and say, do this, do that, don't do this. And the government wouldn't dare stop us. The Constitution would prevent them from stopping us. Okay, we form a corporation. It's still us forming a corporation. What's the difference between us forming a partnership and saying whatever we want with whatever money we have and forming a corporation and saying whatever we want with whatever
money? It's what you said in the introduction, limited liability. Partnerships do not have that. Corporations are protected. People invest in them because of the protection they get. So this is the key. Basically, what's happening here is people know when they buy products and it goes into a corporate treasury, they're not intending to contribute to a political campaign, but that is what is allowed by Citizens United. And so basically they get the benefit of limited liability, but they don't get the responsibility and the limitations that other people have to live by.
So sort of philosophically, the difference between us forming a partnership in which the partnership inherits all the rights of us as individuals and us forming a corporation, the difference is that the if you call a corporation a person and you say it has some of the rights, but it doesn't have any of the responsibility, it's kind of a one-sided thing. It doesn't at least have full responsibility. Yeah, so it's a one-sided thing. So corporations, if they're persons, they're really odd kind of persons with rights but no responsibility or fewer responsibilities.
And you know, they are not, corporations did not form this country. They are not the sovereign. The king was the sovereign, and then the fiction was created in England because they didn't have a written constitution of the queen and parliament. But in the United States, somebody created this constitution, and it was not a corporation. It was people at the Constitutional Convention, and then it was ratified by people who had been elected by living human beings. The corporations have no status in that regard.
So now you're an attorney. You've been in the Senate. So let me ask you sort of a factual, non-philosophical question. Did the Supreme Court realize that saying what seems like kind of a technical thing, that on this particular thing, the ability to give not to the campaign but to this independent thing, corporations can now do what people could always do and can still do, did they have any idea it would make the huge difference that it's making in this campaign now?
I think they had to have known that it had was going to have a significant impact. It might even be greater than they realized. But the fact is, what had happened was the McCain-Feingold bill had limited the unlimited contributions being put through the parties. They could no longer do that. We had stopped that loophole, and the people were turning to the Internet. And we had $10, $25 contributions. College students were giving money. What I like to say is, and believe, is corporations saw the face of democracy in 2008, and they were terrified. And so this decision was engineered to put the genie back in the bottle and let corporations dominate our democracy. And to me, it's really a crime against our democracy that's been perpetrated here.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about corporations and the future of democracy in front of a live and lively audience at Stanford University. We've got some questions from that live audience over here on this side of the auditorium. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir. Tell us your name and where you're from, and then your question or comment.
Sure. I'm Kabir. I'm an undergraduate here at Stanford. And my question is, if corporations are taxed and regulated and interact with the government in many ways, why should they also not be given the right to advocate for their interests using money?
Well, obviously, everybody who is part of a corporation can advocate just like anyone else. I mean, when I was on Stephen Colbert, and that's a tough gig, believe me, he said to me, what do you have against corporations, Russ? If you see a corporation when you're walking down the street, do you cross the street? He asked me if I'd let my daughter date a corporation. You know, I've got nothing against corporations. Yes, they should have. But look, the First Amendment is incredibly important, but it's not the only thing that's important. What precedes the First Amendment is the creation of our democracy, the fact that we as human beings elect our elected representatives. If their ability to dominate the electoral process destroys the idea of one person, one vote, that is just as important as the issue of free speech. So these things have to be balanced.
More questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talks. I'll go back and forth between the sides of the auditorium.
Thank you. My name's Bill Softke. I live in the neighborhood. Here's a different philosophical angle I haven't heard you bring up. Our legal system, every part of it, from evidence to presumption to how minds work, from Hammurabi on through common law and now, was built for persons, human beings, with feelings, loyalty, compassion, guilt, repentance, that kinds of thing. But profit-making corporations are structured to be not only incapable of, but statutorily prohibited from compassion. In what legal or logical universe is corporate personhood supposed to work?
That's a really, I think that's an excellent question, a superb question, because look, one of the things about, back to the first question, on one hand you might think, well, corporations are formed by people doing things together, and the rights of the individuals acting should aggregate up, you might think, to the entity they create. But here's the difference, and you really put your finger on it. Corporations have a responsibility to one thing and one thing only, the bottom line of their shareholders. So if they're persons who are legally required to have one and only one interest. With you, I can appeal to you in all kinds of ways. I can appeal to your compassion, your morality, your shared sense of purpose, your whatever. A corporation, they can't legally be moved by anything except their own bottom line. That makes them, if they're persons, really pathological persons.
Without a doubt. And the notion that you can kind of transfer your personhood into this other entity is sort of odd. I mean, people have a lot of different roles. They're presidents of the Rotary Club, they're a deacon in a church or whatever, but when you come back to exercise your rights as a citizen, that is a fundamental right that everybody has, and you don't sort of transfer it into another entity so you get two kicks at the cat. You know, I have a limited liability corporation, Russ Feingold, right? Well, that's just so I can put checks in if I make any money on this book, right? I don't think the LLC should get to vote too, in addition to me. Corporations can't vote, and they can't run for office. So how are they persons in the political sense if they can't do those things? There's no logic to the Supreme Court's argument on that.
No, I was just going to point out you are a corporation, but you only have one vote, and you're happy with that, even when you're running for office yourself.
A person can be a corporation, create a corporation mm-hmm. that they have an involvement in, but there's only one capacity in which I can exercise the right of being directly involved in giving money and being involved in political process, and that is as an individual, not through the limited liability corporation.
And when you give money, if you were to buy an ad, say, for Obama, just to pick out a wild thing, not give to his campaign, but spend the billions you get from this book.
It's only $1 billion.
$1 billion so far. You're going to spend a significant amount of that for Obama. If you did it as a person, that would all be money you'd already paid taxes
exactly.
on.
Exactly.
If you did it as a corporation, it could be money that was shielded from
taxes. And that's what
taxes.
You're seeing right now.
Yeah.
With people, you know, what you might think is, how come public corporations aren't doing this so much? It's a lot of private corporations. Privately held corporations, very wealthy people like the Koch brothers who control their corporation, they are the ones who are probably more likely doing this than the public corporations, who are a little nervous about this.
So when you watch TV, it sounds like there's this guy in Las Vegas that's supporting Gingrich, but it's really not him. It's a corporation.
Well, of course, the money, he directs it, but it is done through a corporate form. He doesn't run the ads directly. Hi, I'm Mr. Adelson, and I want you to vote for Newt Gingrich. That isn't how it's done. It's done indirectly, and that's what Citizens United allows.
Let's take more questions from our live and lively audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. My name is Hamid. I work at Stanford. And I was curious whether any of you have heard of benefit corporations, which, unlike normal corporations in which a CEO may be sued for not making profit its primary motive, they take social and environmental concerns as their prime concern. Would that be a future change?
Well, you know, I'm concerned here about corporations not invading and destroying the political process. A whole separate topic is whether there should be further restrictions or opportunities created for corporations through changes in the law. Corporations do have certain responsibilities, fiduciary responsibilities. They have responsibility to their stockholders. But as a matter of public policy, the country can say, look, apart from that, you have to do certain things with regard to the environment. That's up to the people, living, live people with blood pressure, to make that decision, and we can decide that for corporations.
Right. I mean, the important point about that is that you think of persons, human persons, as endowed with certain inalienable rights, natural rights. Many of us believe that. Some people don't, but many believe that. But a corporation, as an artificial creation of a state that is of a collectivity, I mean, it's up to us to decide how these things should be organized. I mean, the question is not just given. I mean, there are people who think, who are deep believers in free enterprise, and I'm a believer in free enterprise. Madison, one of our great founding fathers, you know, one of the points of the Constitution, he said, was to protect property rights, to protect the rights of the property from the rabble who would, if aroused, seize their property. And the Constitution is supposed to make that, not make that happen. So people think that, well, if you want to protect property rights, it just follows automatically that corporations should be unregulated, free. But that I think that's a non sequitur.
It doesn't make sense. I mean, how is it possible that the founders of the country lived at a time when the only way you could get a corporate charter was directly from the crown? How does this become something that actually has a right to free speech to the point where it can undercut the very democracy that the people created? It is so illogical and ahistorical that it's almost mind-boggling.
Well, so maybe the more radical question is, do we really need corporations at all? I mean, you could shield people from certain kinds of liability by direct laws. In Nebraska, where I come from, which is thought of as a pretty conservative state these days, but they've had some pretty liberal laws, and they did away with corporations as far as owning farmland some time ago. And as far as I can see, it hasn't hurt much of anything. The farms aren't less productive. The cows haven't gone to being like unhappy Wisconsin cows. They're still like happy California cows.
Now that's over the line. And by the way, that state you just described has two senators, and they deserve them.
But John, I mean, limited liability is a great human invention. It is an engine of amazing wealth creation. So I wouldn't want to throw the water baby out with the bathwater, but it's a really delicate balancing act. And I wonder, how do we balance the upside of limited liability with the downside of limited liability?
We had it balanced before Citizens United. You know, the people of this country went through the robber baron era. And they said, wait a minute, just a few people control all the oil. Just a few people control all the beef. We're going to pass some laws. So they passed some laws that said, actually, there's a limit to what corporations can do, but we kept the corporate form, and I support the corporate form. Why is it an answer just because we need to go back to what worked for 100 years to say, let's get rid of corporations completely? I do think corporations are a very useful and important way in which people take risk, as you said.
The term robber baron is a little sensitive.
I understand
here,
that.
Here on
you
campus.
Notice that I didn't. My apologies to Mr. Stanford.
Yes. What? We used to be the Stanford Indians, and when one of our presidents did away with that, bless his heart, long before it became too big a thing, there was a vote of the students what to call us, and the winner was robber barons. But But the athletic department wouldn't go for it.
And they were overridden probably by the Board of Trustees. But you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about corporations and the future of democracy with former U.S. Senator Russell Feingold.
What should we do ideally about corporations? What can we do practically about them?
We're coming to you from Coverley Auditorium on the Stanford campus. We'll take more questions from our live and lively audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Why should I pay for sidewalks or bridges and roads or your sex protection or your damn building codes? Of course I don't pay, but it's no thanks to you. You'd close every loophole that I wiggle through. Got me a jet and I go where I please. I won't let you people chop me off at the knees.
I got a super PAC. Americans for an American America. Because I got the jack.
Time to go on attack. I'm the 1%. You're just a sad sack. What have you got?
I got a super PAC. Americans for an American America. Because I got the jack.
The Playtones, Merle Kessler and Joshua Raoul Brody. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're talking about corporations and the future of democracy with Senator Russell Feingold, author of While America Sleeps, a wake-up call for the post-9/11 era. Senator, so there was an article a while ago, a few weeks or a month or so ago, in the New York Times about a beloved corporation in these parts of the woods, the Apple Corporation. It was about their sort of global network of suppliers and the labor practices at them. I don't want to hammer on their labor practices or anything like that, but there was a quote from an Apple executive which, like, deeply disturbed me. He said, talking about America's problems, the exec said, "We don't have any responsibility to solve America's problems. Our sole responsibility is to produce the best iPhones and iPads and computers that we can. We sell them in over 100 countries. We have no special responsibility to the U.S. Okay, but look, Supreme Court says, you're a person. You're a person among us. You're one person among others. But you have no particular ties to this polity that we are, this collectivity that we are. I find that a deeply disturbing idea. Am I right to find that?
That's a perfect illustration of what's wrong with this decision. You know, that corporation, Apple, has a right to defend itself against these charges, to run as many advertisements as they want, you know, as BP's doing, for example, mm-hmm. to defend what they did. You know, we're cleaning up the Gulf. That is perfectly fine. The difference is when they take the money you spend on buying an Apple device out of their corporate treasury and use it in an unlimited way to affect the electoral process, that's a whole different thing. Because we may need to pass laws to do something
right.
about these practices.
Right, right.
We once passed the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, so American corporations overseas can't bribe. If corporations become part of that group that's deciding what the rules should be, there will be no rules.
Especially if it's really an unsustainable thing to say, well, they're persons among us, but they have no kind of responsibility to us. I find that an unreasonable thing.
But suppose we made you king for a day, more powerful than the president, more powerful than Mitch McConnell. You actually could just write the legislation and it would be it. You had one day. What would you do?
Well, I would overturn the decision and I would create public financing of all American political campaigns, voluntary public financing.
Good day's work.
Would you repeal limited liability?
No. Look, as long as you have an electoral process where the average person's vote counts, they can decide what they want to do with limited liability or not, or create social responsibility for corporations. But when you destroy the very integrity of the process that makes that decision, you've got nothing.
I got you. More questions from our live audience on this side of the auditorium. Welcome to Philosophy Talks, Eric.
Tom Linebarger with Occupy Redwood City. And you already asked my question. I was going to ask you, how do we take the money out of politics? Obviously, with corporations taking such a big amount of money, My understanding is that Wall Street took 40% of all profits made in the U.S. last year. With them taking that much money, it impoverishes all the rest. So like the banks that are foreclosing on in Redwood City, 166 homes last month in Redwood City, that is taking away 20 or 30,000 from the city's treasury per house. And it's destroying our system. So we do have to have public financing, and we do have to have a way of taking money out of politics.
That's right. And let me say this. It isn't just about the election. It isn't just about the, you know, after you figure out maybe your guy won or your gal won the election. It doesn't stop there. What do they do when they get there? Our problem in the 90s that McCain and I tried to deal with was corporate Democrats as well as corporate Republicans. You know, these votes were 90 to 10 for these trade agreements. 90 to 10 to let the media become concentrated and cut out freedom and diversity in radio. 90 to 10 to allow Wall Street to go wild and repeal Glass-Steagall. So this is why I think the Occupy movement has been so valuable and effective, because it has raised the issue of the unfairness of the way people of great wealth and interests of great wealth have acted. Not that there's anything wrong inherently with having wealth.
You know, largest corporations these days are huge multinational operations. So another thing that's odd is that, okay, as multinational operations, we call them American corporations, but they're global entities. Even if they're not persons, here's the thing I think is deeply challenging for the 21st century. How can we here locally, right, in our local democratic polity, how can we regulate and moderate these huge entities that span the globe? I mean, some people say 21st century is going to be the century of China. I think it's going to be the century of the global international corporation. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, the first step is to make sure that foreign money doesn't come through the corporate form and control our democracy. To me, that's not just foreign money, but huge corporate money from multinationals is what led to a lot of those votes that I just talked about. It is possible, though, to pass legislation, as the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act illustrated. American corporations have not been able to go overseas and bribe, as other countries can, for 20, 30 years. And some people say, well, that puts our corporations at a disadvantage. Right. What some corporate people tell me is it's a good thing because they can't shake you down in these countries because they say, look, it's against American law. So we can, through our laws and, of course, through international agreements for corporate responsibility, we can have some control over this. But it's very, very difficult compared to the past.
On this side of the room, welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. I'm Hazem Nassar from Menlo Park. Should we ever consider corporations as people, because people die, corporations don't.
Well, corporations dissolve, they go bankrupt. That's a kind of death, I guess.
Oh, come on. I mean, person is a really old natural concept that humans have used and philosophers have developed for centuries. And politicians, whether they're Supreme Court justices or legislators in these states, shouldn't take I'm talking as a philosopher. Concepts are what make thought and intellect and rules and democracy possible. And you can't just abuse them by saying all of a sudden something is a person when it's not.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
So John objects to the corporations not because of the violence they do to the environment and all that, but to the violence they do to concepts.
Absolutely. Yeah. I agree. Yeah.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk today.
Hi there. My name is Luis J. Mojardo from Mountain View, California. So you've discussed some of the disanalogies between corporations and ordinary persons, and particularly with respect to the ideas of full responsibility and limited liability. But of course, we don't force persons who declare bankruptcy into slavery or indentured servitude. So it seems like persons have limited liability as well. So my question is, what would it even be for a corporation to be fully responsible liable?
But it's a good question, but think about this. A corporation goes bankrupt. The CEO has in personal assets $1 billion, right? You can't get the personal assets of the CEO. So it's not like if I had no more resources and you tried to get more, you'd be squeezing water from a stone. But if you got a billionaire CEO who has his personal assets separated from a corporation, I don't think that would be squeezing water from the stone to ask him to bear. Look, if the CEO makes the decisions as an agent in the world and the corporation is the thing that bears responsibility for those decisions, that shields the CEO from the ordinary human responsibility.
And I don't support the full responsibility idea. I think we need corporations. I think we need the corporate form. I think we can do more to ask for responsibility. But if we turn it into something that's of no use, that doesn't allow and cause people to invest money, that would be a mistake. But we're frankly nowhere near that.
I just want to add a little footnote. When Mark Twain invested in a typesetting machine that wasn't the Linotype and turned out not to win, invested a lot of money, and his company went bankrupt. And he felt so responsible that he spent 10 years of his life when he was getting old, should have retired, was very famous, giving lectures, working night and day to pay off all the debts that he wasn't legally required to pay because he went bankrupt. Now, compare that to Donald Trump, who's gone bankrupt maybe 30, 40 times. That is, he starts a hotel. If it doesn't work out, he goes bankrupt, and the people that bought the leases of their condos are screwed. So there's changing conceptions, whether we're talking about corporations or about individuals, about exactly how much personal responsibility there is. And so the idea of having this special form of business that encourages it seems to me a little bit dubious.
Well, let's take one last question from this side of the...
Hi, I'm Stephen Prisicaro. I'm a junior at Westwood High School in Austin, Texas. So as corporations rise, would politicians only need to win the support of corporations and not individuals? And if so, would that change our democracy into a plutocracy?
That's the word. That is exactly where we're heading. I still believe that people will rise up as they did during the Gilded Age, and they'll say, wait a minute, enough of this, that people will realize that they do have the right to vote. And that even though there's all this money being spent and their voices are getting drowned out, particularly with the internet, I still think there's a way that in races where too much money is being spent on one side that possibly they can begin to overturn it. But it requires a powerful populist movement to say, we will not have our democracy become a plutocracy.
It's, corporations can't vote, and I don't think we're ever going to, but the money is what is used to mobilize people, to inform them or misinform them. And so if all the money is coming from, then the only voice you hear in deciding who to vote for is the corporate voice, and the voice of the individual is drowned out. And that,
well, it drowns out the candidates. And I know that sometimes we get a little skeptical about candidates and their sincerity, but how do you even hear the positions of the actual candidates? If they're following the law, you know, these super PACs can't coordinate with the candidates. If you believe that, I got a bridge for you. But the point is that how do you get to decide between candidates when what they put into the race is paltry compared to what's going to dominate television? It really denies people the right to even know the direct words and voices of the candidates who are asking for their vote.
Well, Senator, there's a lot more we could talk about. This is a deep and fascinating conversation and a hard issue, but I thank you for making a contribution to our discourse.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Senator Russell Feingold. He's a former three-term U.S. Senator from the state of Wisconsin. He's the Mimi and Peter E. Haas Distinguished Visitor at the Haas Center here for Public Service. He's author of While America Sleeps, A Wake-Up Call for the Post-9/11 Era. John, I got to tell you, I've always thought of Senator Feingold as one of the truth speakers in public office, and I always thought, I want that man to be president. But, you know, almost all the people I want to be president never become president, so...
Yeah,
what do you think of that?
Either of us might be the curse of advocacy for it. Well, you know, when we planned this program, we had the problem of, well, who's going to take the corporation side? None of the three of us probably are naturally inclined to do that. I'm not sure we solved that problem. I mean, you gave it a shot. But anyway.
Well, I mean, I think it's obvious we want something like limited liability. We want these great engines of wealth creation. That's amazing. That's amazing, but we've got to manage the downside much, much better than we have. And what we need in office are some wise and thoughtful, philosophically minded politicians
When I was growing up in Nebraska, we used to take vacations in Wisconsin, where I had an uncle once removed who had a dairy farm. And from the point of view of Nebraska, Wisconsin was a vacation wonderland. I mean, it was just part of the mysterious East, you know, Des Moines, Chicago, Milwaukee, New York, Paris, Budapest. And so I really wanted to move to Wisconsin in spite of all the unhappy cows they have there. Now I want to move to Wisconsin so I can vote for Russ Feingold next time he runs for whatever he's going to run for next.
This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. You can also find out more by visiting our very active Facebook page and following our tweets on Twitter.
And you can sign up to get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk. You do that at our website, philosophytalk.org. And now, we form a limited liability corporation for speed with the fast-talking Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, the Cato Institute is a Beltway think tank founded in the 70s, quote, dedicated to the principles of individual liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace, unquote. It was named for the Cato Letters, a series of 18th century essays written by two British writers who signed their essays after Cato the Younger, a Stoic Roman who didn't like Caesar so much that he disemboweled himself. Charles Koch was one of the founders. Now he and his brother David are allegedly planning a hostile takeover of the Cato Institute. Ed Crane, Cato Institute co-founder and president, told the Washington Post, quote, this is an effort by the Kochs to turn the Cato Institute into some sort of auxiliary for the GOP, unquote. Of course, Crane also told a reporter once that, quote, global warming theories give the government more control of the economy, unquote. I suppose that's true in the same way that giving guns to police gives them more control over criminals. Who knows what the Koch brothers have in mind for the Cato Institute? We do know that they are much hated by the left for putting their money where their mouth is, and not just in politics. David Koch has given millions to ballet, to the Lincoln Center, the Museum of Natural History, and cancer research. But the Kochs are in the oil business, so they have also given millions to undermine climate change research. They helped fund the Tea Party. Their organizations include Citizens for a Sound Economy and a spinoff group, Citizens for the Environment, Americans for Prosperity, and Patients United Now, which I'll bet does not like Obamacare. They have so many front groups in political circles, they are known as the Kochtopus. They've also been sued for sneaky market maneuvers for employee deaths by fire, benzene spills, oil spills. Koch Industry has been lobbying to prevent the EPA from classifying formaldehyde as a carcinogen. Did I mention that Koch Industries makes formaldehyde? David Koch has given more than $40 million to Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, where he has a research center named for him, and his very own endowed chair. Whether this chair is hand-carved from formaldehyde, I do not know. Is this hypocrisy? No, it's libertarianism, where selfless ideology merges effortlessly with naked self-interest. Now, I don't know what the Koch brothers have in mind for the Cato Institute, but I do find it ironic that the Institute is resisting the takeover. After all, isn't this the free market in action? Shouldn't they just fall on their swords like good soldiers and let the generals Koch have the field? Putting one's money where one's mouth is admirable, I suppose, but if I put my money where my mouth is, it would be the equivalent of whispering in a stadium among a crowd cheering for a touchdown. When the Koch brothers put their money where their mouth is, they own the stadium, both teams, and the copyright and the fight songs. Take that, Caesar. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2012.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Music from Merle Kessler and Joshua Raul Brody, the Playtones.
Special thanks to Stanton Lawrence, Linnea Costantino, and Wrapped Productions.
Thanks also to Dan Brandon, Caitlin Ash, Merle Kessler, Dave Millar, Jimmy Tobin, and Corey Goldman.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from very many groups here at Stanford University and also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk.
And from the members of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Those of you who have seen the film Moneyball or have read the book by Michael Lewis will be familiar with the story of Billy Bean. Billy was supposed to be a tremendous ball player. All the scouts told him so. They told his parents that. They predicted that he was going to be a star. But what actually happened when he signed a contract, and by the way, he didn't want to sign that contract. He wanted to go to college, which is what my mother, who actually does love me, said that I should do too, and I did. Well, he didn't do very well. He struggled mightily. He got traded a couple times. He ended up in the minors for most of his career. And he actually ended up in management. He ended up as a general manager of the Oakland A's. Now, for many of you in this room, ending up in management, which is also what I've done, is seen as a success. I can assure you that for a kid trying to make it in the bigs, going into management ain't no success story. It's a failure. And what I want to talk to you about today and share with you is that our healthcare system, our medical system, is just as bad at predicting what happens to people in it, patients, others, as those scouts were at predicting what would happen to Billy Beane. And yet, every day, thousands of people in this country are diagnosed with preconditions. We hear about pre-hypertension. We hear about pre-dementia. We hear about pre-anxiety. And I'm pretty sure that I diagnosed myself with that in the green room. We also refer to subclinical conditions. There's subclinical atherosclerosis, subclinical hardening of the arteries, obviously linked to heart attacks potentially. One of my favorites is called subclinical acne. And if you look up subclinical acne, you may find a website, which I did, which says that this is the easiest type of acne to treat. You don't have the pustules or the redness and inflammation. Maybe that's because you don't actually have acne. I have a name for all of these conditions. It's another precondition. I call them preposterous. You know, in baseball, the game follows the pregame. The season follows the preseason. But with a lot of these conditions, that actually isn't the case, or at least it isn't the case all the time. It's as if there's a rain delay every single time in many cases. We have precancerous lesions, which often don't turn into cancer. And yet, if you take, for example, subclinical osteoporosis, a bone thinning disease, a precondition, otherwise known as osteopenia, you would have to treat 270 women for 3 years in order to prevent one broken bone. That's an awful lot of women when you multiply by the number of women who are diagnosed with this osteopenia. And so is it any wonder, given all of the costs and the side effects of the drugs that we're using to treat these preconditions, that every year we're spending more than $2 trillion on healthcare, and yet 100,000 people a year, and that's a conservative estimate, are dying not because of the conditions they have, but because of the treatments that we're giving them and the complications of those treatments. We've medicalized everything in this country. Women in the audience, I have some pretty bad news that you already know, and that's that every aspect of your life has been medicalized. Strike one is when you hit puberty. You now have something that happens to you once a month that has been medicalized. It's a condition. It has to be treated. Strike two is if you get pregnant, that's been medicalized as well. You have to have a high-tech experience of pregnancy, otherwise something might go wrong. Strike three is menopause. We all know what happened when millions of women were given hormone replacement therapy for menopausal symptoms for decades, until all of a sudden we realized, because a study came out, a big one, NIH-funded, that said, actually, a lot of that hormone replacement therapy may be doing more harm than good for many of those women. And just in case I don't want to leave the men out, I am one after all, I have really bad news for all of you in this room and for everyone listening and watching elsewhere. You all have a universally fatal condition. So just take a moment. It's called pre-death. Every single one of you has it because you have the risk factor for it, which is being alive. But I have some good news for you because I'm a journalist. I like to end things in a happy way or a forward-thinking way. And that good news is that if you can survive to the end of my talk, which we'll see if that happens for everyone, you will be a pre-viver. Now, I made up pre-death. If I used someone else's pre-death, I apologize. I think I made it up. I didn't make up pre-viver. Pre-viver is what a particular cancer advocacy group would like everyone who just has a risk factor but hasn't actually had that cancer to call themselves. You're a pre-viver. We've had HBO here this morning. I'm wondering if Mark Burnett is anyone in the audience. I'd like to suggest a
a reality TV show called Previvor. If you develop a disease, you're off the island. But the problem is we have a system that has completely, basically, promoted this. We've selected at every point in this system to do what we do and to give everyone a precondition and then eventually a condition in some cases. Start with the doctor-patient relationship. Doctors, most of them, are in a fee-for-service system. They are basically incentivized to do more procedures, tests, prescribe medications. Patients come to them. They want to do something. We're Americans. We can't just stand there. We have to do something. And so they want a drug. They want a treatment. They want to be told, this is what you have. This is how you treat it. And if the doctor doesn't give you that, you go somewhere else. That's not very good for a doctor's business. Or, even worse, if you are diagnosed with something eventually and the doctor didn't order that test, you get sued. We have pharmaceutical companies that are constantly trying to expand the indications, expand the number of people who are eligible for a given treatment because it obviously helps their bottom line. We have advocacy groups, like the one that's come up with Previvor, who want to make more and more people feel they are at risk or might have a condition so that they can raise more funds and raise visibility, et cetera. But this isn't actually, despite what journalists typically do, this isn't actually about blaming particular players. We are all responsible. I'm responsible. I actually root for the Yankees. I mean, talk about being sort of rooting for the worst possible offender when it comes to doing everything you can do. Thank you. But everyone is responsible. I went to medical school, and I didn't have a course called How to Think Skeptically or How Not to Order Tests. We have this sort of system where, that's what you do. And it actually took being a journalist, to understand all these incentives. Economists like to say, there are no writing stories, that thing. He learned from watching this kid who he eventually hired, who was really successful for him, that it wasn't swinging for the fences. It wasn't swinging at every pitch like the sluggers do, which is what all the expensive teams like the Yankees like to pick up those guys. This kid told him, you got to watch the guys and you got to go out and find the guys who like to walk. Because getting on base by a walk is just as good. And in our healthcare system, we need to figure out, is that really a good pitch or should we let it go by and not swing at everything? Thanks.
Taylor, WHFR, Dearborn.
You are now listening to WHFR, 89.3 FM on your radio dial. I am the Diva, and my show, Lyrical Infusion, is on every Monday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. Join me as I serve up some mental musical gumbo for your moody Monday pleasure. You can always listen live to W.